Hello, welcome to IN, a series of live online conversations with practitioners in the visual arts. IN is broadcast by New Local Space, a micro gallery and contemporary art initiative in Kingston, Jamaica, a subsidiary of audio production house Creative Sounds. This morning, I'm chatting with London-based art writer and curator Rosanna McLaughlin. McLaughlin is in residence at NLS for 8 weeks from March to April of this year as part of the Transatlantic Artist Residency Exchange Program, which is supported by the British Council. McLaughlin is currently researching into the legacy of Cuban-born artist Ana Mendieta and the protest movement that followed her death. Her work, McLaughlin's work has been published in Freeze Magazine, Artsy, The White Review, and BOM. Between 2011 and 2013, she co-ran Hobbs McLaughlin Gallery, and in 2016, she was shortlisted for the Fitzcarraldo Essay Prize. All right, before we get started, I'm taking a moment to let our listeners know you can leave questions and feedback on Twitter to our handle, NLS Kingston, and the hashtag for the show is NLSIN. Rosanna, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, after a lot of technical difficulty, we're finally live online. So Rosanna, your work spans art criticism, creative writing, and curating. You're a regular contributor to Artsy and Freeze, yet you've also written short stories and satire. What would you say is an overarching focus for you, and what are you searching for with your writing, if anything, and how do you reach this via each aspect of your practice?
Well, in the most basic sense, the purpose for writing for me is the creation of a kind of a responsive voice, like the honing of a critical lens through which I can process and think about the world. So writing is really a way for me to get as close as I can to working out what I think about something, which happens in the process of writing. It also enables me to get into much closer proximity to an artwork or an idea or an artist or a point of criticism. And this is something that I really enjoy about art and always have as an area to work in. It's a wonderful way to get to know people, to process ideas. Mm. But for instance, if I'm interviewing someone, within the space of an hour, if I haven't met them before, we might end up talking about politics, sexuality, philosophy, from personal positions as well as theoretical ones. Mm. I don't think I know anywhere else, any other field other than art that facilitates this kind of intellectual intimacy. So I suppose that's like, yeah, that's why I write.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, but there's, I guess it's interesting that you point out that I do a varied amount of things, right, that maybe seem quite different. So I think arts journalism for me is quite similar to curation in that it's a lot to do with finding a kind of narrative thread between ideas or artists. And I also enjoy trying to like maintain my voice and my interests, even as I'm operating within quite strict borders of a format, so review format or interview format or something like that. But as well as this, I work on much longer self-directed projects. And in terms of satire, something that I say quite often in relation to why I write, and why I enjoy writing satirically or critically, which is essentially a process of undermining dominant narratives with other narratives that might be left out, that might have been edited out for whatever reason, is because writing allows me room to express a type of double vision. Lots of people have this thing that I call double vision for many reasons, but from my experience, I attribute this to sexuality and knowing that I was a lesbian from a young age. So I had this thing where I would witness what the straight world looks like and all its peculiar customs and rituals, and then what it things look like from my perspective. So double vision is like a useful way to undermine things which present themselves as axiomatic, as universal truths, when perhaps they might often otherwise be seen as well-worked mythological narratives. Mm-hmm. So satire is my narrative revenge.
Very cool. Are there any pieces you've written specifically, or projects that you've worked on that you felt you were shifted noticeably, your practice shifted, or even your thought processes, and or during which you feel you've discovered something instrumental for you or telling socially? Because as you say, even though you work from a few different angles, practice-wise, I mean, there is an overarching focus, you know, and I just want to know if there was any particular project that you felt shifted you, and also this double vision that you talk about.
Well, I suppose the idea is, in an ideal world, that everything that I did would shift me, because that's kind of the point. But like, when you write about something, you really like get intimately involved in an idea or a subject area, and by the end of it, you will have been able to clarify the position that you didn't necessarily already had or hadn't had time to clarify. But probably like the two pieces that have had the biggest impact for me, one was published last year called The Pious and the Pummery, which is an extract of a book-length piece that I wrote around Frieze Art Fair in London in 2015. It's an essay, and it sits somewhere between social satire and reportage, and I interviewed lots of artists who had been in the fair, curators, collectors, directors, all about their vastly different reasons for being there, their different aspirations and desires, and quite often pretensions too. And this was potentially quite a difficult piece to publish. If you're satirizing someone, it's important that you're happy to stand by it. So it's quite easy for me to sit behind my laptop in my dressing gown at home and like write all kinds of things about, like, you know, do all kinds of character portraits that I think to myself are like funny or clever or whatever. But it's quite another thing to stand by that. So I think that taught me a lesson in considering how far to go with criticism and how personal is too personal. But I guess the other part of it was, am I going to shoot myself in the foot for criticizing a major arts organization? And I did learn some things about what it's like to write an art in the arts then, because there were like various people were very nervous about publishing it. And I realized then how sensitive the art world is to criticism. Difficult it can be to offer that kind of criticism because art is such a social business. The rule is don't criticize each other. But having said that, it was probably the most popular piece I've written. And I've continued to write for free since. So it has proved it is possible to offer criticism, but it's a little bit nail biting.
Yeah. How long have you been writing? Go ahead.
Well, I guess I've enjoyed writing for as long as I can remember. Likewise, the same with art. So when I was, I'm just thinking back to when I was at school, the art rooms were the only place in the school where you could try and engage with ideas outside of the status quo. I mean, I was quite lucky. I had an amazing art teacher. He was openly gay. He would lend us his books. He let us play his CDs. He introduced me to Nan Goldin's photography of queer New York, which had a huge impact on me. And he let us come in at lunchtime and hang out. People used to go in the dark room and like snog in free periods. So there wasn't really any other place at school where I was introduced to a way of life where a subject was so deeply entwined with like desire, friendship, community, possibilities for lifestyle, I suppose. Yeah. Elsewhere, lessons were things that you, information that you have to remember. So I suppose art has always been a way of life. It's not only been artworks that I make or writing that I do. So originally I went to art school, and when I graduated, I moved back to London where I'm from, and to realize how hard it is to find a place to exhibit or a place to have a studio. The art scene felt quite cold and commercial and impossible to find any place of entry. And so I moved into a place called Lima Zulu Project Space, which is like a gallery and a warehouse where a good friend was living. And there are probably about 12 other people who are living in there. They had a communal living space in the gallery. And from then I became interested in creating a platform, a conversation, and the social element around art. And I started organizing shows as well as exhibiting artwork and writing about shows. And then after this, I moved to a flat with Melissa, who was at the time my girlfriend, but is now my civil partner. And we moved into a, do you know what civil partners are? Do you have?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of weird, right? Because it's like a, seems like a British anomaly.
No, I mean, we don't have that, it's.
Yeah.
That's definitely, we do not have that in Jamaica, right? You know, we're really not at the same place socially.
But they're also kind of weird civil partnerships because they were brought in because people thought that it was unfair that gay and lesbian people couldn't get married. So they had this like civil partnership idea because religious people were frightened that God would be angry if gays went in church or something like that. I don't know. So we had this like other thing for gay people, and it had the really unsexy name civil partnership. But it's really good because it recognizes like union in law and stuff like that. And but now it's kind of a total anomaly because gay people and lesbians can actually get married because the law changed, but they can't get rid of civil partnerships because they'd have to admit that they came out of a position of prejudice in the first place.
Right.
And now they're really popular and straight people want civil partnerships too, but they're not allowed them. So it's like, yeah, I quite enjoy it.
That's hilarious.
Queer culture is quite good at making things desirable to other people.
Yeah, that's hilarious that no straight people want that option.
So Melissa and I moved into this like tower block in East London, like a big concrete brutalist tower block, and we started holding exhibitions in our flat, and every few months a new artist would come in and take over, completely redesign the flat sometimes. Like sometimes we'd have to move all our possessions into a single room. Sometimes like, our bedroom would change place or the walls would change, things like that. But during this time I was writing about living with art and weaving together biographical reflections, art criticism, and whatever else got tangled up in the reception of the work. So that could be anything from like taking out the bins or eating pizza or watching bad TV. I suppose there was a shelf life to that project because there's only so long you can stay in your own home.
Yeah. The apartment gallery. So you consider it an apartment gallery?
I guess so, yeah. There's quite a lot of apartment galleries going on. I guess it's essentially pragmatic because we did want to open a gallery somewhere else, but we couldn't afford it. And so it just seemed like the obvious thing to do. And for me, art has always been a brilliant way to get to know people. So that kind of intensifies, right? If you're inviting an artist into your home to exhibit in your bedroom or something like that, sometimes it can be really uncomfortable, but sometimes it could be brilliant. So I enjoyed that a lot, but the writing that I did around that was really important in that it helped me locate my position as a writer from a personal, my sort of personal biographical relation to art, like linking that in with art criticism and art history and conversations with artists. And then after that is when I began to publish on on like bigger platforms.
Mm-hmm. What I really find intriguing about your work is that you can definitely detect this personal connection that you mentioned, but then at the same time, what's curious about your writing is that you're going in and you get really it seems that you get really intimately involved with whatever subject area that you're studying, but you're so open to whatever evidence presenting itself to that kind of also dictating the narrative rather than you going in and really trying to dictate what's going to come out of the research. So I really appreciate that in your work. There's this openness to having the actual story unfold the way that it is. And then also, as I said, the way that it connects with all of your other work is that personal, this personal connection. What do you hope to achieve with your writing? I mean, you kind of alluded to that, you've kind of brushed on that, but ultimately, what do you hope to achieve with your writing?
I guess from a selfish perspective, I write in order to convince myself that I know what I'm talking about. So I can work out what I think about something. And I guess you have to hope that when you get to that point where you feel quite convinced, that it will be of some value to other people. I suppose, as you say, like I am fairly open to, you know, I don't necessarily come at a subject with my eye, with my mind already made up. Mm-hmm. That's part of the joy of like writing, is that I quite literally find out what my position is through the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I hope in the end that I have something that's worth saying. And I guess also because I am a big literature fan, that I'm able to say it well and that it sounds convincing, and that maybe that I sound open-minded, but also quite like sure. So I sound like a kind of trustworthy voice. I mean, part of that, I mean, I don't want to like spoil the illusion, but I suppose that's part of the craft, right? You've got to, you create this voice that people respond to in a specific way. So that's part of it. And I hope that it's, in the end, I guess, I hope it's a voice that people enjoy like reading.
Yeah. You're here at NLS for a residency as part of the Transatlantic Artist Residency Exchange between the UK and the Caribbean. The program is supported by the British Council. And we have two artists from the Caribbean, Camille Cheddar from Jamaica and Josh Liu from Trinidad, who are going to the UK. And then two art practitioners from the UK who have come to the Caribbean. Yourself from London and Joanna Helford from Scotland, who is at Alice Yard in Trinidad. So I'd love for you to tell us a bit more about the project you're working on while you're here at NLS. You've blogged about it. You've started blogging about it, but I think this would be a really good opportunity to talk a bit more about what you're working on while you're here.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So as a kind of an overview, I'm researching the history of the protests and the responses, I suppose, that followed the death of the artist Anna Mendieta in 1985. Many people believe that her husband, the minimalist sculptor Karl-André, killed her. He was tried and acquitted for second-degree murder in 1988. And since then, there have been protests sporadically when his work is shown. The first was in 1992 in New York, where Andrea Mendieta lived, and the protest was at the Guggenheim. There was a show being mounted, which Andrea was included in, which had five white men and one white woman. I think it was called From Brancusi to Bourgeois. And so the Guerrilla Girls and a group called the Women's Action Coalition organized a protest, which is partly about Mendieta's exclusion, but already she'd come to sort of stand in for like much bigger complaints. So Mendieta was Cuban, which is important to this history. And at the protest, people were chanting, "Where is Anna Mendieta?" And that question then became it started to mean more things than just "where is she?" It's "where is the work of women?" And "where is the work of women of color from public institutions?"
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for anyone that doesn't know, she fell or was pushed from the 35th floor of the apartment that the couple shared. So Andre currently has a touring retrospective, which began in 2014 at DIA in New York. And this sparked a whole load of new protests organized by a different generation of artists. In New York, they're organized by a group called the No Wave Feminist Performance Task Force. And the strategies that group used in the protests were quite different. They used aspects of Mendieta's art. She has, in her work, she uses a lot of blood. And she's famous for making these pieces called the Silhouette series, which are outlines of her body made in materials including mud, fire, blood, and snow. So the protesters at DIA dumped some blood onto the doorstep of the gallery, which is a reference to one of Mendieta's artworks, and they made some silhouettes in the snow outside and poured blood into those as well. And there was lots of controversy about the protests, especially from people who knew Mendieta, who were also feminists, who were critical of the group as being opportunistic and sensational. Some people, accuse them of being careerist, trying to exploit her death for their own gain. And there was
How would they have exploited her death?
I suppose because it was bound to get a lot of newspaper attention, right? So it was an opportunity to do something quite headline grabbing, essentially. I'm not sure I'm really on board with that critique, because I think from what I can tell from speaking to people who are involved in the protests, they felt they had a really, really deep connection to Mendieta's work. And it wasn't really to do with publicity. It was more just to do with outrage that that Andre was suddenly being, because Andre hadn't had a retrospective in the States since Mendieta's death. He continued to be popular in Europe, but New York had quite a close-knit art community when Mendieta died, but really, really deep divisions over those who backed Andre and those that backed Mendieta. So it was the first time it happened, and there'd been like a kind of conscious effort to reframe him as a this sort of aging genius who'd kind of been unfairly maligned in like major publications. So lots of, you know, there was lots of interviews and articles written about him in the run-up to this big retrospective. And so there was a lot of unease about engaging in a kind of post-death canonization of Mendieta, which didn't really have much to do with her art and her life, but had everything to do with the construction of female experience as kind of a victimhood, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be really interesting and complicated terrain. The question of like, how should we mourn people that we don't know? And also, if we believe that a person has been murdered, and that the law has failed in its judgment, how do we make this known? What options are available other than protest? So after the protest at DIA, the Tate Modern in London opened its Switch House extension. And in the new hang, one of Andre's sculptures was exhibited, and there wasn't any work by Mendieta. And a different group called Where is Anna Mendieta mounted a protest then, too, in fact. And these had got much more aggressive. Their people would Oi Tate, we've got a vendetta, where the fuck is Anna Mendieta? People were banging on the windows. And also, it was the first time, really, that Andre was explicitly being accused of murder.
Yes.
So people had placards saying Carl Andre is a murderer, and this huge banner with Carl Andre murdered Anna Mendieta was placed over Andre's sculpture in the Tate. So it had quite a different tone by that point.
Yeah, to rather than the open-ended question that the first iteration of that movement had around after the court case, right?
Yeah, but likewise in these protests, references to men of red blood. Well, they're like red blood on their arms. I think it was just paint, but in reference to some performances she did called Body Tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, again, I was interested in the protests. On the one hand, I think it's important to offer up counter narratives by those ignored by the law and big institutions, because the art world did rally to Andre's defense. You know, there's a lot of money put up for his bail. $500,000 of bail was put up, and there was a kind of a code of silence, like not to speak, not to try and defame Andre. So he was really, the art world really did protect its biggest investment. And Mendieta might be very famous now, but she wasn't during her life. She wasn't an asset as such. So yeah, the conflict I found is, I think it's really important to build it up, offer up these counter narratives, but at the same time, I could see why people might be uncomfortable with the way that Mendieta had become this almost like two-dimensional figure, like a martyr of sorts, and that her work was being used to symbolize her death, like the blood that she used, which was chicken blood, and wasn't, it wasn't, you know, when she was making that work, she wasn't making it about domestic violence. One of the protesters that I spoke to referred to her as the abject, brutalized Cuban body, rather than calling her Ana Mendieta. And that in itself seemed to kind of symbolize something odd that was going on, where her identity had become exactly that, an abject, brutalized Cuban body. She was very far from being abject in life, by all accounts. I've been speaking to a lot of people who were involved in various stages of the protests, from the people who knew Mendieta when she was alive, some of the most ardent critics, people such as Coco Fusco, who really have been very outspoken in criticizing the protests, and people who think that they're really important. And I guess I've been reading a lot as well, trying to figure out a position, trying to work out what these protests mean in the current state of like extremely heightened identity politics.
Yeah. Would you say that you're researching to her legacy and the controversy around her death? What do you think this research has to offer to your practice, but also to us, the wider public?
On a personal level, I find it just completely fascinating, just because there's so many different like narratives going on, and there's so much on either side of the debate, there's so much ideology involved, that so much of the conversation can end up being about trying to prove whether Andre killed her or not, which, I mean, I personally think that he probably did, but I think that there are other things that we can look at, such as how the art world responded and such as how people are responding now, that can give us a kind of a more concrete grip on if, I don't know, like we could then make a judgment on how the art industry responded to her death in a clearer way. There are concrete things that we can hone in on. So I thought that could be an important contribution to the conversation. I also think the responses to Mendieta's death are really important because they do show the way in which institutions and markets historically protect their own. And in a contemporary sense, the wider questions that the protests and criticisms of the protests raise touch upon some really like pressing and thorny contemporary debates about identity, as we're seeing now with the Dana Schutz case. The question of who gets to speak for who gets to mourn who, and whether it's right for people outside of certain communities to reproduce the trauma of others is extremely pertinent. We're at a moment where it's really important that we are that solidarity is a must. But at the same time, that identity politics have, and with justification, pointed out that the wounds of some people are not a free for all. And I guess essentially that's Coco Fusco's criticism, is that these protesters don't have any connection to Ana Mendieta. They know her only through the lens of her death. And then you might get, you can end up in this situation where you get kind of an obsessive interest in the dead body of a Cuban woman from people, for instance, based in London. So it's interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but why, you said you personally think that he did it. I mean, I can't help but think that, why do you think he did it?
Well,
because you have this intimate, you've now been like researching this for quite some time. And I think that, I think it factors in. I think what you found would necessarily factor into sort of validating even the mechanism, studying the mechanisms of, as you say, how the industry closes ranks and protects its own, and basically how power is preserved, mechanisms of how power is preserved. But why do you think that
as is the right of someone being prosecuted in New York, it's your right if you're deemed innocent to seal the court case, all the files and all the testimony forever so no one can access it, which is what Andre did when he was found innocent. So there's this one book essentially that operates as the only evidence of what happened in the case, written by a guy called Robert Katz. It's called Naked by the Window. It's a completely amazing book. And that has, he did a lot of work transcribing testimony in court and interviewing people. So that is anyone that talks about the case who wasn't present in the courtroom is basing it on this one piece of journalism that has a lot of kind of literary ambition as well, which is interesting because it's already, it's based on a story of sorts because there's no access anymore to the raw material. And in that book, it just, I guess, a lot of evidence didn't make it into court because of police procedural errors. So Mendieta's body was never photographed. And that can be very telling if you're like with the position someone lands when they die, when they've fallen, whether or not they've been pushed or they've jumped. There's some other evidence as well that she was terrified of heights. Everyone that knew her said she was terrified of heights. And in order to jump out of the window, she would have had to have climbed up on a ledge. It would have been above her waist height because she was very small, and jumped, and there was no footprint bound on the ledge, on the window ledge. Which essentially means it's very unlikely, since she was found without any shoes on or socks on, it's very unlikely that she would have stood on it if there's no footprint, so maybe she was thrown. I guess that's the narrative, but that wasn't this evidence or this kind of lack of evidence in a way that there was no footprint wasn't allowed in court because the proper warrant wasn't got when the police searched the property. And so essentially the judge in Katz's book, he speaks to the judge and the judge says, essentially he thinks that Andre probably did it, but the case legally wasn't strong enough for him to convict him. And it was up to the judge because Andre opted to have a trial by judge and not by jury, which is very unusual, but is also your right in New York, in the state of New York. So I guess it just seems like one of those cases where the evidence admissible for someone to prosecute, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It just seems that.
Yeah.
Like it's like the ruling was made on the quality of the case rather than what seemed probably obvious to most people had happened. Andre's story also changed quite a lot of times. At first, when he phoned 911 to report the death, he said that they'd had an argument about the fact that he was a more successful artist than her. And then the second time, he said, in fact, that they had an argument because he'd refused to go to bed with her. And then he'd actually discovered that she must have jumped sometime later. And then in later interviews with the police, he said that he was so drunk that he couldn't remember. So, yeah. It doesn't, whichever way you cut it, he doesn't come out of it looking very, very good.
No, not at all. You've been here in Jamaica for a little more than 3 weeks now. Has your ongoing research and this project on Ana Mendieta, has it resonated with your experiences at all while you've been here in Jamaica?
Yeah, perhaps even more than I had thought, actually. It was, you took me, Deborah, to the Tambourine Army March, which was kind of an amazing reminder of how important protest is. And the measures that people have to take when other channels are shut down, particularly in relationship to violence against women. So it had a clear resonance with what I was researching. And I guess also the risks involved and the bravery involved in taking them. I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce her surname right, but Nugent, is that how you say her surname?
I think so. That's what you mean.
Yeah, so her arrest following the march on like pretty shaky charges seemed like a, you know, she's a very brave woman. And I also, there was some debate before the march about whether the Tambourine Army were being too violent, whether they'd used the right symbolism in their graphic design. And it made me, it kind of reminded me how easy it is to debate like the means of protests and forget the point of the protest in the first place. No protest is perfect. There isn't really, how can it be perfect? But protest movements do have to strike out and start from scratch. And it was a lesson to me to think about what constitutes the right target for critique, thinking about the Anna Mendieta case. How much is it important to criticize what methods protesters use in their protests? Isn't it just important that the protests are happening?
Totally. There's a lot of controversy here around what's an appropriate way to protest and what's not. And then, of course, also suppression of the protest movement, right? With the arrest of LaToya.
Yeah.
You've met people working in various fields related to cultural studies and your areas of interest in a broader sense while you've been here. Could you tell us about some of these conversations and how they've shaped your understanding of the space? As you say, you literally came right into this whole protest, the Say Their Names campaign. That kind of unfolded like almost immediately after you got here. But how have the conversations that you've had also shaped an understanding of this space?
Yeah, right. I mean, just to go back to that Say Their Names protest, there's such a clear parallel with, you know, people often criticize whereas Anna Mendieta protesters for calling out Andre as a murderer. People feel very uncomfortable about that. But it's like, if you actually think that's what happened and the law isn't supporting you, how else do you raise that point? It's exactly the same thing as the Say Their Names thing. Like, what other recourse to action do you have? The first person I met when I arrived was Tracy Robinson, who's an academic at UWE. And she introduced me to a publication called Small Acts that I wasn't familiar with. And we discussed some notions of queer theory in relation to the Caribbean, which was, I found very interesting. She sent me some incredible essays, one by Nadia Ellis called Out and Bad, which essentially tries to turn dance hall into something queer, which I haven't totally made up my mind about whether that's possible or not. And another very interesting essay by Gloria Wecker on Matty work, type of queerness in Suriname amongst working class women. It was amazing to see those discussions from a Caribbean perspective. And also discussing at Mendieta's story with Tracy, she had not heard of her before. She reminded me how racial identities in the UK and the US are limited essentially to two categories. You're either white or you're a person of color. It doesn't matter if you're from like Havana or you're from Delhi or you're from Cairo. But she points out to me that in the Caribbean, Anna Mendieta would have been considered a white woman because she's of Spanish descent. And that color privileges people experience in the Caribbean may not be experienced in the States. And I thought this was a really interesting observation in that it showed the extent to which identity categories are discursively produced and not necessarily universal. So that was really helpful in a broader sense. I also met Sonia Stanley Nair, who gave me a brief introduction to the history of performing arts in the Jamaica, and Lisa Tomlinson. Both of these women work at UWE, who I spoke to about the differences between Santeria and Obeah, because Mendieta refers a lot to the Cuban practice of Santeria in her work. And I've also spent quite a lot of time at the National Gallery, which has been amazing.
So what has been most surprising? What have you been most surprised or struck by here within the visual arts or the wider culture here in Jamaica?
I suppose primarily I've been struck by the amount of like powerful female voices there are, whether academically, artistically, or politically. I enjoyed seeing the campus at UWE so full of young women. Obviously, I've was then introduced quite quickly to the idea that this might be a problem that men aren't so well represented in academia and the social context of that. But I guess it's worth celebrating the potentials of predominantly female spaces and the sorts of academic, political and cultural conversations that will develop out of them. I think that's amazing. And not necessarily something that fits with like the UK image of Jamaica, where the conversation tends to be about masculinity. If Jamaica comes up,
really,
you know, well, yeah, it's like people. If you think of dancehall, people tend to think of male dancehall stars, and then people think of like when dancehall gets in the news, it's normally something to do with homophobia, right? So there's like, unfortunately, this like fairly like conversation is limited to masculinities in my experience.
Yes.
Which just doesn't, maybe it's just who you guys hook me up with. It doesn't seem to match at all.
With what I'm doing. It doesn't seem to match at all with what's actually on the ground.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. It's good to offer some depth there. Tell us about some of the art that's most exciting to you now happening in London.
I guess I'm very excited to see a film by an artist named Emily Pope, who's been making a series of films based on like the sitcom model, that TV show format, where essentially where you offer up various identities that you choose from, and it seems to offer diversity, but really it's extremely limiting. So it's like, are you Phoebe from Friends or Rachel from Friends? Or are you Samantha in Sex and the City or whoever else is in Sex and the City? Essentially, you're choosing like which wealthy heterosexual white woman are you? Normally, that's the case. And I guess Emily's work shows life that's... Emily's sitcoms are kind of really grimy, and they're based on her own life and friends and the reality of living in precarious housing in London and not having any money. They're funny, but they're also like a really astute critique of the way in which class and economic reality is left out of the identity equation. Obviously, I seem to be really interested in identity at the moment. And I guess I'm looking forward to where we go from here in terms of understanding our identities. Like, will the next few years see an even more pronounced focus on how we define ourselves as individuals? And will and can this also include a push for solidarity and collective activity? I think that's a big question. Also at the moment, the UK is in like in my opinion, a kind of a nasty moment. There's a horrible rise of xenophobia, hardline right-wing conservatism, that many people who consider themselves like generally liberal didn't really expect to happen. And so I'm excited, I suppose, even though I'm saddened by it, I'm excited to see how people in the arts respond. Mm-hmm. Because for a long time, I don't know, I guess art is not explicitly political, although it can engage with political conversations. But when it's encouraged and allowed, it's an amazing opportunity to, you know, for people to express themselves. But when it becomes under threat, perhaps like it is in the States with the funding of the National Endowments for Arts being cut, then it becomes political. And I'm interested to see how people respond to that.
We have one question that just came in. Someone is asking online, how can they see these films by Emily Pope?
Oh, well, I'll find out.
Okay.
I don't know, because I know that she exhibits them as artworks, so I don't think that they're necessarily available on Vimeo or anything like that. Mm. But I can look into it.
And then we can post on our YouTube channel in the comment section. Once we have those answers, we can post them in the comment section on YouTube.
Yeah, right. She definitely has a website, so we can put that up.
Okay, great.
Cool.
So you've started planning some, that's actually a really good question to lead us into one question that I have as we wrap up, which is you've started planning some of your public programming around your project here. as part of your residency at NLS. What do you have coming up? What do you have planned while you're here?
So this coming Wednesday, I'm doing a seminar at Edna Manley at the Art School about writing as a career in the arts, which I hope will also help artists who want to get better at writing about their work too, because writing, for anyone working in the arts, writing is a very important tool. You need people to write about you, but you also have to be able to write about yourself. And on Saturday the 1st of April, we're going to be screening Ana Mendieta, Fuego de Tierra at NLS, which is a documentary made during Mendieta's lifetime that includes footage of her and her work. And it was released in 1987, 2 years after her death, and just before Andre's trial. I'm really excited because I haven't seen this before. And also, I'm going to be giving a talk on April 22nd, based on the research that I've been doing at NLS. And I'm hoping by then to have the Guerrilla Girls have sending some posters that they made that are related from the original protests and later, comparing Carl Andre to OJ Simpson. So I'm hoping to have those to show as well.
Okay, great. I'm excited. It's been a pleasure, really, Rosanna, having you here so far. And I'm really looking forward to what comes out of your research and following your blog. That's been really a great experience too. And I'm looking forward to continuing to follow your thought process through that. Everyone come to her screening that's coming up on the 1st of April, and we'll send out some more, we'll send out invitations for the talk on April 22. But it's been a true pleasure. Thanks, Rosanna, for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Bye.